Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Abe Friedman, a partner and head of PJT Camberview, based in San Francisco. Abe joined PJT Partners through the acquisition of Camberview Partners in 2018, the firm he co-founded in 2012 and served as its CEO. Before Camberview, Abe was managing director and global head of corporate governance and responsible investment at BlackRock. Prior to that role, he served in leadership positions, including global head of corporate governance at Barclays Global Investors and chief policy officer and general counsel at Glass Lewis, a firm he helped co-found in 2003. In this podcast, we talk about his successful entrepreneurial journey in corporate governance, what he sees as the greatest shift in the role of institutional investors, and the state of play in shareholder activism. We also discuss the post-proxy season, the focus on ESG, say on pay, and regulations on climate and human capital management. Finally, we address the corporate governance challenges of private tech companies, the rise of private markets, and much more. If you like this show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Abe, it is such a pleasure to see you again. It's great to have you in this podcast. I'm very excited to talk about corporate governance with you, being such a central figure over the last decade or more in this world. How are you doing? And thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
I'm doing great, Evan, and it's great to see you. Always love spending time with you, so I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Excellent. So as you know, we typically start with your origin story and we talk about our guests. And why don't I first start asking you, where did you grow up? And then we'll move into more of your professional background until your position now with PJT Camberview.
A sort of complicated origin story. We could spend an entire podcast on that. So simplicity's sake, what I'll just say is I grew up in LA, various parts of LA. And then moved up to the Bay Area when I went to Berkeley for undergrad and grad school.
Okay. So you went to law school and then what did you do after law school?
After law school, I actually had another interesting story. I had a job working at a law firm that I had committed to, but then my wife got, my fiance got a clerkship on the Ninth Circuit. And so I asked the law firm if I could defer and go with her to Seattle for the year while she clerked. And anyway, through a long series of interesting conversations, I wound up getting a job working for the phone company for US West. And I had what I thought was a really super interesting job as the manager of regulatory affairs for the state of Washington at US West. And it ultimately had me decline going to the law firm, moving into this different direction of working right in-house at a company straight out of law school and doing all kinds of interesting legal and policy work in telecom.
Okay. And from there, when did you make the transition into more of a governance role? And essentially, maybe in those years, the role of governance wasn't really a career, was it?
No. I mean, I never studied anything to do with governance in law school or heard anyone sort of thinking about or talking much about governance at that point. But really it was getting into telecom that got me into governance, because when I worked at a second telecom company, we moved back to Northern California. That telecom company, our general counsel and our investment banker got together and created this idea of forming a company, which they called Glass Lewis. And they asked me if I would join at the beginning and help them build this company. And I agreed to do that. And I built and led the proxy research business there, which was interesting because I was really learning governance at the same time as I was helping to build this business around governance. But it was a really interesting time. It was just after Enron and WorldCom and Adelphia and Tyco and all the big corporate scandals. And ISS was a monopoly at that point. They had been two firms, but ISS had acquired the other firm, or the other firm had acquired ISS. I can't remember exactly how it went, but in any event, they became ISS. And so there was the market was ripe for some disruption in the space. And I had a feeling as I researched and learned about the space, as I was thinking about joining Glass Lewis, there was really huge opportunity here. And so I did join, and that was the beginning of my governance trajectory.
That's great, because it's really interesting. It's an entrepreneurial story, right? And normally not associated with lawyers. So it's great to hear about the origin story. Of course, Glass Lewis has become one of the leading proxy advisory firms out there, doing a lot of work for many companies around the world. And then you joined Barclays Global Investors.
Yeah, which was amazing. The Barclays Global Investors is probably, other than Camberview, the most amazing place I ever worked. I mean, culturally, an incredible firm. The people were amazing. The things that were happening there, sort of pioneering on the investment front, both in terms of quantitative investment, but also the beginnings of the ETF movement, the creation of the iShares business. There was so much happening at BGI that was just incredible. And it was an amazing place to work. I just absolutely loved being there.
And interestingly, I see you were there from 2005 to 2009. So you hit the financial crisis right at the end. That must have been a little bit more shocking, or at least the market was impacted. So how did you live through that?
It was a really crazy time, right? And a really interesting time. And being at BGI during that moment was actually really interesting, because I feel like I had kind of a front row seat to what was going on. I remember on the floor that I sat on wasn't exactly filled with like the senior executives of BGI, but during the crisis, they were using a big conference room down on our floor, probably in part to be sort of tucked away a little bit, having sort of daily long marathon sessions about our counterparties and what was going on. And so anyway, I had an opportunity to kind of observe all of what was happening in the market, sort of affecting our business, and watching kind of up close as our leadership team was navigating it, which they did quite successfully. But it was a scary and weird time.
Well, and then they got acquired by BlackRock, which I suppose then you started working in BlackRock, which has become the largest asset manager in the world. And maybe talk to us about that transition and then your work as the, you know, governance chief at BlackRock.
Yeah, BlackRock was really good to me. BlackRock had a global head of governance, and they separately had a global head of their responsible investment efforts. But they asked me to stay and to combine those and to lead it for the full firm once we were integrated, BGI was integrated into BlackRock. And you know, it was fascinating. It was really interesting. All of these issues were on the cusp of getting more attention at the top of the house in the asset management space. You know, governance had kind of been something that investors had to do because the pension funds and some of the union funds and others were expecting and, you know, demanding that their asset managers do focus on this. But it was sort of a, we have to get this done kind of job historically. But it was turning into something that was much bigger, especially with the merger with BGI and BlackRock, with BlackRock becoming so large at the time. I think they had $3.5 trillion in assets mm-hmm. after that merger, which made them the biggest by far. Now I think they have $8 trillion or something.
Right.
So quite different. But the, you know, the focus and attention from regulators, from the public, from companies, and then also from investors, meaning the people who actually put their money with a firm like BlackRock, was just really ramping up. And so it was a really interesting time to be part of that narrative and that discourse and what was going on both internally, but also in the rest of the world. And, you know, BlackRock was, yeah, it was an incredible, it was an incredible spot to be in a moment of so much change in the space.
Right. I do remember meeting you at that time, and we were collaborating at Stanford, and BlackRock was obviously a big part of the institutional investor world. And then you decided to leave and to start your own firm, Camberview Partners. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, most people thought I was crazy because I think, you know, it was sort of widely acknowledged that I had kind of the coolest job in corporate governance. Like if you were going to be in corporate governance, you wanted to have an impact. Right. You know, it was hard to imagine that there was a place you could have more of an impact than being the global head of that function at BlackRock, because BlackRock voted more shares than anybody. We had, you know, the biggest stakes in all these public companies around the globe. And so it was a big decision to take a leap and venture out to start something on my own. But fortunately, I had some phenomenal mentors and friends who believed in me and believed in kind of the idea and what we could do. And then we set about to do it. And, you know, the great news to that story is that Cameron View has been a huge success and had a huge impact in the market, advising companies around all sorts of shareholder issues over the last 9 years. And it's been, it's been extraordinary. It's been, it was maybe the hardest decision I ever had to make professionally and probably the best decision in terms of just what it's created in the market.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk more about Cameron, obviously. So why don't you tell us what was your reasoning behind, and I like, again, you can see this entrepreneurial spirit that you have over your career. You know, what was the focus? And then maybe we should talk about the acquisition in 2018 by PJT Partners, because now you're part of a investment bank. So that's, again, another iteration on your firm. And it's really interesting talking about it from the outside as an observer in the governance world. Your model has been very unique and very successful. So I think a lot of people are interested in the story, at least, you know, maybe those that do not work in the space also maybe don't know as much as those that are in the governance professional realm.
Yeah, well, thanks, Evan. I think so. The story of building Cambry from the outset is really, we were at a moment in the evolution of governance where I felt, and several other people that I knew felt, that the market was going to change and companies were going to have to start caring a lot more about the people and the institutions that were voting their shares than they did historically. And the drivers of that were really two things. One, post the financial crisis, Dodd-Frank brought say on pay to the US and required investors essentially to vote on the executive compensation of the CEO and the top five executives of every company in the country, basically every year. It took a little bit of time for it to become an every year thing, but that was essentially what was happening and where the world was headed. And the second thing was that, you know, what had been sort of corporate raiders of the 80s and 90s turned into shareholder activism and a less negative slant in the market in the 2000s. And shareholder activists were just beginning to start to make some inroads and occasionally have a success with the company by getting other investors to support them, which was something that hadn't really happened historically. And one thing that I could see really clearly from the inside at BlackRock, and that my colleagues from Vanguard and State Street and Fidelity and Wellington and all the other big asset management firms where our colleagues at Cambridge came out of, we were all sitting there watching this change unfold in a way that didn't seem very apparent to companies, but was really clear to us. And that change was that these activists were starting to take more investments in more companies. They a lot of money flowed into activist funds during the financial crisis because people were looking for ways to drive alpha or find, you know, opportunities to make money in a complicated environment. And some of those funds were performing quite well and making good bets. And so as the money started to flow into those, and the activist firms started to really build their presence, they were spending a lot of time with people like me at the big institutional investors because they were repeat players. They were coming 4, 5, 6 times a year with different campaigns against different companies. And they were spending time trying to understand our decision-making process, trying to understand how we worked, how we thought about the issues that that they were presenting, what would drive us to vote in favor of them in some situation and against them in lots of other situations. And they were learning a ton. Companies, on the other hand, at that point, were still not doing in the US much engagement at all with investors. Let me pause on that. They were doing a lot of engagement, as they always had, with you know, IR heads speaking to to fundamental investors and CEOs and CFOs speaking to fundamental investors. What they were not doing was spending a lot of time with the voters, people like me and my team at BlackRock and at, you know, at the big institutional investors. And they didn't, they were not sort of learning how we thought or understanding. And it was very interesting. I mean, you know, universally, if you asked anybody in my job at that time, whether it was, you know, my colleagues from Vanguard or, you know, T. Rowe or Fidelity or whatever you wanted to ask, they would all tell you, you know, companies would come to see us and no matter who it was advising them, they had the best advisors you could find on Wall Street. They didn't know who we were, the people in these jobs. They didn't know how we thought about the work we were doing. They didn't understand how our proxy committees or our internal processes really worked to make decisions. They made a ton of assumptions about how we used proxy research, which were largely wrong. And sometimes 180 degrees wrong, often 180 degrees wrong. And you would have conversations with companies that would occasionally come because they would have some issue on their ballot that they were worried about. And they were super unproductive. It was almost like you would have like the same meeting over and over during proxy season, like six times during the day, because you go from company to company and they would all be, you know, complaining about ISS and telling you how, just because you, they know you follow ISS, but they really would appreciate it if you would think about it differently. And they just didn't understand that actually we didn't follow ISS. We didn't really care what ISS's conclusion was. We were just using it as a tool for research, and they didn't know what we actually did, what process we actually followed. Anyway, activists were beginning to understand that. Companies really weren't, and there wasn't anybody giving them good advice to help them understand that. And so I thought that activism was going to take off in a different way than it had. And very luckily, that was the case. Turned out in retrospect.
No, and I have to say, I remember having conversations with you when Sayon Pei was on Dodd-Frank and you were, well, this is a really bad idea. Well, it didn't turn out a bad idea in the long run for your firm, but hey,
that's true.
That's true.
But I agreed. I wasn't a fan of Sayon Pei. I didn't think investors voting on Pei made sense. I still actually don't think it's the most logical approach to how you would deal with this topic. I think shareholders elect the board. The board really needs to set executive compensation. And if shareholders don't think a company is getting it right, they have mechanisms for, you know, voting for different board members or whatever they think is the right answer. But I was never a fan. But anyway, it came into existence nonetheless, and it was destined to come into existence. And it was the other driver because you know, companies were starting to really realize, geez, these folks in these voting teams have quite a bit of impact on things that matter a lot to us as management teams and boards. And between activism and Sayon Pei, those two things really opened the door to.
Yeah. And I should say that your firm is very unique because you took this niche and became a very strong player. I have to say, for those that don't know, the acquisition of Camberview was $165 million. That was what was reported outside. So in the governance world, you created a new category of firm, right? Typically, you had advisors who were investment banks and law firms and IRs, and you created this investor advisory firm for the first time. And I think this is unique in the US, and I think in the world that doesn't exist, maybe because in the US, the capital markets are structured in a way that institutional investors matter, but it's also going abroad. And you do have presence in the UK and Europe, and that's growing. So that's why this is so important. You mentioned BlackRock. Why don't we talk a little bit about institutional investors, because this is a story of governance, and we've had many guests in the show talking about the change and the evolution of governance. You know, how do you see this role? You kind of hinted, or you talked a little bit about, you know, what was happening among your peers. You know, this evolution of the role and influence of institutional investors within governance. You know, what's the latest, and what do you see in the next few years? Is it too much, right? A lot of academics talk about these funds getting too big, and, you know, some have talked about the big three, maybe BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, right, the big 12. And eventually now these big firms own about 25% of the S&P 500, but maybe in 10 years they'll own 45%. And is it okay if Larry Fink, you know, has that much influence? And you know, those are questions that are interesting to explore.
Yeah, look, so I think if you think about governance as sort of the three key parties in a governance arrangement in the public markets, you have the board of the company, you have the management team of the company, and you have the investors. the way this has played out over history is actually pretty clear. Before Sarbanes-Oxley, before the big scandals of the early 2000s, in that three-part system, management teams really kind of ruled. They tended to have boards that, as you know, this is general, I'm generalizing, but they mm-hmm. tended to have boards that were not particularly aggressive, let's say, in their oversight, that weren't necessarily stacked with people who had independent perspectives or views on the business and were able to exercise a lot of oversight. Managements tended to rule their companies with a fairly strong focus. And after Enron and WorldCom and Adelphi and Tyco and all those big scandals, Sarbanes-Oxley actually shifted the dynamic and created a lot of rules and also sort of norms around how boards would operate and how much time it would take and how many audit committees a director could sit on. Back in you know, when we were first starting Glass Lewis, before those rules actually all took effect over the next several years after we started Glass Lewis, you know, we would see directors that were on 12, 15 public company right. boards, like regularly 10, no problem. I mean, there was like a small handful of people who were on all these different boards. That changed. I mean, now you don't have directors sitting on more than four or five boards, typically public companies. And that was, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley. The other thing was you wound up having a lot of requirements around independent directors on boards and the balance, and investors had their own demands about how many independent directors would be on a board versus management team members or people affiliated or related to the management team. And, you know, today you have boards that are almost entirely composed of independent directors and very few management directors, usually just the CEO in the US. So the power, if you will, of directors and the board kind of rose up in the early 2000s after Sarbanes-Oxley. When you had Dodd-Frank, you you had a change that put some power into the hands of investors and actually kind of created in the investor community a much stronger voice, the ability to vote on executive pay and what that's yielded in some ways from an investor perspective, the rise of activism and investors kind of asserting themselves in ways that they hadn't asserted themselves historically. And so this three-legged stool today, I think, has a lot more balance than it did, you know, 25 years ago, when you really one part of that stool was strong and the other two legs were not as strong. You can argue about whether that's been a good evolution or a bad evolution. And I think there's, you know, arguments that go both ways, but that's kind of where we are today, is a lot more balance between those three groups. Interestingly, I guess the question will be, is there a fourth leg to that stool? And are we seeing the fourth leg begin to solidify now, which is the sort of stakeholders as opposed right. to the shareholders and impact on employees and communities and others that aren't the board, the management, or the investors, and how those folks are asserting themselves or using the tools of the other three parts of the process in order to achieve certain objectives. But I think that story is being written right now, and I think we'll see a lot of that play out over the next decade.
Yes, I totally agree that we're seeing the surge of this fourth power structure, which is the stakeholders. And this is hand in hand with ESG, right? This environmental, social, and governance movement. And this maybe was something that came out in the US strongly with the Business Roundtable restatement in 2019. It's been a debate, actually. It's not a new debate, right? We debated these issues in the 1930s and with Dodd and Burley, right? There was a debate 50 years ago with Milton Friedman. So it just resurfaces. And it seems like we've had this new moment where if you talk to any CEOs, and I'm sure you talk to CEOs every day, they all will clamor, well, the purpose of our corporation is obviously not for our shareholders, but for everybody. And we think about the environment, we think about employees and customers. What do you think of this new mantra, and is it here to stay?
Well, I think it's definitely here to stay. And I think that companies and investors alike are much more focused on these questions of a company's impact in society, a company's impact in the communities that they're serving. And I think there's just a broader awareness and expectation, in particular by young people coming into the workplace and where the world's headed, that companies are going to be, there's going to be more focus and more attention and more demands on companies to demonstrate what they're doing to further the interests of the communities that they serve and the environments that they operate in. And you can see companies are reacting and spending a lot of time and energy trying to make sure that their story and what they're actually doing on this front is understood. I suspect that that we'll also see more from government on this topic. We already are, but I think we'll see more over the next decade or two, which is really where societies typically come together to think about public governance questions like the environment or social issues. And you'll see some, you know, regulation or other expectations that are set that are sort of common across the market. I think one of the complicated things right now for companies is there isn't really a common set of standards or expectations. There's a lot of different moving parts. There's all these different firms that are rating companies, but they don't really necessarily have good information. There's a lot of investor demands, but they're not always the same. And so in some ways, I think some coordinated and organized expectation setting, if it's reasonable and sensible, is probably what will happen and the better thing to happen.
So within this new world of ESG and, you know, purpose of the corporation, how do you see shareholder activism impact corporations? Have they changed their strategies to kind of fit the purpose and their objectives and their strategies? And what are you, you know, how do you advise companies now in this work with activist campaign contested situations? Has that changed over the last 3 or 4 years, for example?
Yeah, look, I think activists, like everything else, they come in all different stripes. And so it's hard to talk about any piece of the investor community as a monolith. There's, it's sort of like talking about all fundamental investors or all index investors. Like it's, there really are differences, and they're very unique institution by institution. But I will say, I think that there's an interesting phenomenon happening around activism over the last 3 or 4 years in the market, where I think companies and boards and management teams are sort of slightly more risk averse and don't want to take as much risk necessarily with activists. And they're sort of more willing to put activists on the board or to settle with, you know, directors that they feel comfortable with in order to sort of move on and keep focused on their business. And activist campaigns can be super distracting. So there's a lot of, you know, good reasons underlying that. On the other hand, I think some of that is for the good and some of it hasn't been for the good. I don't think that every company in America necessarily needs an activist on the board. And I don't think every activist operates and behaves in ways that are actually useful for the market and for investors overall and should be on every board. And I think I hope that we will get to a, if you think historically we were in an environment where folks, every company, certainly big companies, absolutely 100% of the time resisted activism or never in a mood to talk about putting somebody on their board unless they decided that they wanted to do that. The pendulum shifted a little bit too far the other direction, and hopefully we'll get to some happy medium where there really is more thoughtful focus on, is this activist really right? Is this activist really representative of the broad base of shareholders? Is there a way to manage this that isn't so all-consuming and distracting for the business and allows us to get to a place where we can push back on this, where we should push back on it? And are there moments where companies should embrace the activists and actually bring them into the fold and work with them because their ideas are good ideas or because their ideas are transformational ideas or, you know, and if embraced, will have a good impact? So I think, you know, I guess what I would say is the thing I would like to see is a little more balance. And I think there are some companies that absolutely should fight on the activist front. And I think it's absolutely doable to fight and to win and to be effective and successful and still run your business. And I think there are some companies where actually, you know, it makes more sense to work with the activist and find a solution and move on without without a lot of disruption, other than some maybe innovative disruption. That's good disruption.
Okay. So I know, like, you can't talk about any specific client work, but obviously we are in a proxy season that just happened where Exxon got an activist. And independently of the players surrounding that, here is a case of a activist who had a very small stake in the company and was capable of convincing large institutional investors plus the proxy advisors. And I think that's a surprise that somebody with less than 1% of the equity was able to get three members of the board of Exxon. And maybe that's a wake-up call for other corporations where, look, if they are able to convince, and it's become a little bit political, right? Like it's a campaign where you kind of put your case together and you go out there and you discuss the merits. And it doesn't matter how much money you have or how much money you invest, but if the merits are good enough, and now you can leverage the largest investors who are, as you said from the beginning, the people who vote. So that's really interesting. So I'm sure your role now is taking these campaigns and taking these merit discussions and situation where it's become a much more relevant discussion on governance.
Yeah, well, look, I'm not going to comment on any particular company, but I will say a couple of things that I think are highly relevant to, mm-hmm. to the question, which are, number one, it's almost time-honored tradition at this point, but it's very common in my experience for public companies to underestimate the extent to which investors don't really care so much about the messenger as they do about the message.
Right.
And you could see this in campaigns by, there was a small union group, again, I won't comment on any particular investor, but there's a small union group that's run a lot of vote no campaigns against mm-hmm. public companies over the years. And most companies don't even know the initials of this organization. They don't, they get a letter from them and the letter's a little hostile and, they throw it on the heap. And occasionally I've had clients that like, oh, I got this letter 2 months ago. And I'm like, you got that? Like, why didn't you tell me 2 months ago? They think that, that organization, nobody knows that organization, or that organization doesn't have a lot of money in our company or whatever the case may be. And they mistake the same principle with a gadfly investor who owns like $2,000 of stock and puts some proposal to separate the role of chair and CEO, whatever the case may be. You get some very small investor that's not particularly well known, certainly isn't well known to the management team, has not been in the stock very long necessarily, has never been vocal before, and suddenly they're showing up with a message that and investors are listening to them, and companies are like, wait a minute, that person only owns $2,000 worth of stock. Like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. But the point is that investors have never really cared about the messenger. They care about the message. They care about the substance, whether or not the arguments being made or some of the points being made actually make sense, or whether change on a particular topic or a particular board or whatever would be useful from an investor perspective. And so one thing that I think hopefully everyone can see plainly today in the corporate world is that actually it doesn't matter the size of the investor. It doesn't matter whether people like that investor or don't like that investor, or know that investor or don't know that investor. What matters is whether they believe in the substance of what's being delivered. And in the case of director nominees, or they think the director nominees of an activist or anybody else are better than the ones that the company's put forward, that kind of thing. Those things are the things that are going to drive outcomes. The other thing I will say is the need for companies and the importance of companies to think about changing the way that they manage their investor relations in today's world has never been stronger. And companies, most companies in America, I would say, are still operating in an old and I would argue outdated model mm-hmm. of managing investors. And that old model was really tailored to a world in which fundamental investors, long-term, long-only investors were the key drivers in the marketplace. And those folks had, relationships and built investments in companies where they believed in the management team, they believed in the strategy. And they were typically historically like the friends of the company. They were there for the long term, believing in what that company was about and where they were headed. The world doesn't operate the same as it did anymore. Money is flowing out of fundamental investors faster than anybody can count. It's flowing into index, it's flowing into quant, it's flowing into activism, it's flowing all over the place and out of fundamental investing, which you know, there's, you know, a lot of years of data now suggesting that a lot of these other ways of investing are outperforming fundamental investing. And so that's a key driver. But the IR function of most companies is designed around building relationships and dialogue and constant communication with fundamental investors. And the reality is that today's IR function needs to be built to address a much broader set of constituencies, and CEOs and boards and management teams overall need to pivot and adjust their investor strategy for, you know, where we are right now in 2021. And it's different. And I think a lot of companies are still trying to working its way through. And the need to tend the voters at your investors, the need to tend investors who don't know as much about your story or in your stock because you hit a quant screen or because you're in the index, and how to engage with those investors and how to understand what their expectations are. That's all becoming at least as relevant as the old way of thinking about investor relations.
Okay. No, I think those are great messages. Simple, but direct and kind of product of what's going on. You know, other issues that are evolving a lot are, you know, we've talked a little bit about climate change, but now there's this new wording of human capital management. And the SEC and the government is trying to disclose or make new disclosures around this. And also diversity, not only from the SEC. We saw the NASDAQ proposal. California has proposed SB 879 or 826 and 979, sorry, on diversity of boards, on gender and on minorities. So this is changing a lot. Why don't we talk about that? And how do you see the changes in those two angles?
Look, I think we are living through a time in our country where there's a tremendous amount of change. There's a tremendous amount of discontent with how we have dealt with issues of racial discrimination, of ethnic, gender, other forms of discrimination. And I think we're all living through quite a moment of change. And I think that change is valuable and going to put us in a better place longer term, but we're in the middle of it. And I think that has impacted the investor dialogue and company dialogue. It's impacted how companies are thinking about this from their own employee and workforce perspective. What are the demands and expectations of young people coming into the workforce? What are the questions that they're asking companies? What are the things that they care about and value? How do companies attract and retain the best talent that they can find out there? In all forms of diversity that it comes in, and how do they operate in ways that will embrace that workforce and allow them to leverage the best of what we have out there? And this moment of change that we're living in is going to be with us for a while, and it's going to forever impact, I think, the way companies operate in the market and what the expectations are. And you can see it. You can see the huge push in the corporate world for expanding diversity in boards of directors. We've had a real push around gender diversity, and you can now see a much broader push around racial and ethnic diversity. You can see companies changing how they think about diversity in their workforce, not just in the boardroom. And investors have been asking a lot of questions, and you can see the demands from investors actually increasing substantially over just the last 2 years on these questions. What are their expectations around board diversity, and at what threshold are they going to start to vote against boards if they don't feel the board is making progress on that? What we heard a tremendous, during COVID in particular, just an incredible amount of discussion between companies and investors around human capital management. How were companies dealing with employees in this moment of complexity? What were they doing? Were they laying people off? Were they furloughing people? What was the impact on the company when they wanted to, you know, start things back up? What are the impact on employees and communities and all sorts of expectations that we had never seen from investors before around human capital management? And I don't think that conversation around human capital management ends if COVID, you know, finally, hopefully subsides at some point, that conversation is now part of the expectation in the investor company dialogue. And so things around these topics are growing and they're changing fast, and they are not going backwards. They are going to keep going down the path that they're going down. And I think, you know, companies are embracing this themselves. Where everybody, I think, in society is learning and watching and trying to pivot where pivots need to be made to really begin to actually hopefully make some change, as opposed to just some talk that we've had, I think, on these topics for years in our country.
Yeah, agreed. And you know, the last question on governance is a little bit more, since I'm based in Silicon Valley, there's been a lot of talk about governance of private companies, startup governance. And, you know, whereas before it may have been a narrower market because venture capital was smaller, startups were not as prominent, we've seen the rise of these unicorns. Private markets are tremendously more deep, and a lot of the public investors are going into private companies. I think the latest number is 900 unicorns around the world. It's a much bigger space, as you know as much as I do, that governance in private companies is a completely different world, right? The composition of boards is still startup focused in terms of you only have investors and founders, maybe one or two independent directors, as opposed to what you said in public companies, where the majority, if not all, the directors are independent. So how do you see that convergence, if there is any? There's the whole question of founder control, which is a very different and deep question, but is that something that you also are looking into? I mean, considering the rise of private markets?
Yeah, it's actually quite extraordinary the extent to which we've been asked by private companies over the last few years to provide advice. Both friends of mine who are in, you know, involved in early stage companies, and also folks that have come to us through various business channels around thinking about investor relationships, thinking about what the difference is between being a private company and a public company, how to prepare for becoming a public company. These are topics, you know, you asked early on about PJT. I never really got into that part of the Camberview journey, but PJT Partners is a phenomenal firm. It's been an incredible partner and a great home for our business. And it's turned out to be, you know, a really, really exciting chapter in our business. But our one of the, you know, there's some big changes that are happening with our business that are actually not driven by being at PJT, but are opportunities that being in the PJT platform make even more exciting. And sort of two of them are, I would say, one at a macro level, we have grown our practice to be much broader than the sort of governance focused practice that it was when we first started the business, right? My background is the head of governance globally at BlackRock, and my partners from Vanguard and State Street and Fidelity and Wellington and CalPERS and CalSTRS and CREF and all those folks all came out of the governance shops. We started out really advising companies around votes and voting and governance and building investor dialogue with the voters, the institutions. But our business, we've now hired the former portfolio managers and analysts from many of the biggest investors across the street. And our practice is really expanded to be advising companies across all investor issues. If you want to do a really deep, really thoughtful survey of the investors in your stock, and I don't mean just the governance and voters, I mean like the portfolio managers and analysts who are covering your stock, we do that. If you want to figure out how to identify new investors to come into your stock because you want to remake your shareholder base, we're helping companies do that. You want to understand how to talk about your story to the street and to the portfolio managers and analysts who are trading your stock every day in the midst of a transformation or a challenge in your business. We're doing that. And so our business has really grown to be a solution business for companies that have any challenges or want to pursue any opportunities on the investor front. And one of those, to get back to your question very specifically, is around private companies. And, mm-hmm. and that whole part of the business actually has multiple legs as well. There's the pre-IPO channel and helping companies that are thinking about going public understand what life is going to be like when they do become public, helping them think about making sure that the investors that they're marketing to during the IPO process are the right investors so that they get good outcomes on the other end of their investor base being public, helping companies aside from IPOs that are private but have investor challenges. It's a little more complicated in the private context, right? Because in the public markets, you know, there's like 30 or 40 big institutional investors who kind of own, you know, huge stakes in all of the public companies out there. In the private context, there's lots of different investors and lots of different players, but the issues are actually remarkably similar. Mm-hmm. And navigating them and the strategies for navigating them are also remarkably similar. And so there's a ton of opportunity for us there, helping companies really think about when they're faced with investor challenges as private companies, how to navigate those to successful outcomes and manage their private investor base in a way that yields positive and effective results. And again, we've built such a diverse team since we've been in the PJT platform. I think we have close to 70 people on our team. Most of us spent our careers as investors. Our ability to help companies across all of these various dimensions has expanded and is quite strong. It's been, kind of an exciting chapter at Camberview these last few years.
Yeah, that's great. And it's great to hear. I mean, obviously, I deal mostly now with private companies, and I see the value, or at least the vision of governance traditionally has been very different, because dealing with all the players that you just mentioned, historically, there's been an evolution of, let's say, 30 years of governance, and people in private, you know, startup entrepreneurs just have no idea what's going on and don't care, and technology. And you're right that the collision is in the IPO, right? I'm sure, you know, we don't have time to talk about this, but there's SPACs nowadays, there are direct listings, and there's a lot of different mechanisms by which, interestingly, in the pandemic, a lot of companies are transitioning towards public markets, right? There was a talk for a while of companies staying private for longer, forever, and so much money was going into private markets they didn't need to. But now that seems to have historic numbers and IPOs and SPACs and direct listings and new categories. So it's interesting. And I'm glad to hear that you also, I suppose by necessity, right? Just by the size of markets, you get getting into private markets. But let's move into the rapid fire questions. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
The first book I would say that that really grabbed me in a way that no other book had ever grabbed me was back when I was in law school. I read Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety.
Okay.
I just found it to be really interesting, especially at that point in my life, as I was thinking about the future and what I wanted to do and whether I wanted to. I had this idea that maybe someday I might want to teach, and that was about a professor and his family. Anyway, it was interesting. Interesting moment. The Return of Martin Guerre had a strong impact on my life. I read this book in my world history class at Cal.
I hadn't heard of that book in a long time.
Sophomore year. And the reason it had an impact on me was because I took that class with my friend at the time, who then became my girlfriend, who then became my fiance and is now my wife and partner in life. So we studied together and spent a lot of time talking about The Return of Martin Guerre, which was a class we were taking together, the world history class. So that one had a big impact on my life. I don't know. Those are the ones that come up top of my head.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier in your transition to Camberview that you had some great mentors. Let me ask you, who were your mentors and what did you learn from them?
Well, I've been very fortunate on this front. I've had quite a few mentors in my life. If we go back to the earliest part of my life, I was a Boy Scout. I became an Eagle Scout. And my scoutmaster for much of my youth was a man named Marty Berger, who was amazing. And I absolutely loved him and found him to be really inspirational and a great leader. And one of the things that he always told me when I was in scouts was, there's never enough time to do it right, but there's always enough time to do it over. And he was all about sort of, you know, just getting it right the first time. And in business, I've used that actually my whole career. And in business, it's sort of, there's never enough time and money to do it right, but there's always enough time and money to do it over. And it's amazing how companies and businesses that I've been involved in, you know, will want to scrimp on something and then pay later much, much more rather than getting it right up front. And so I just think there was a lot of wisdom in what Marty taught me when I was a boy. One of my other mentors was my grandmother. My grandmother back when, 40 years ago, when I was a little kid, was, doing yoga every day. And she had a compost in her backyard and recycled everything and was all about growing her own vegetables in her garden. And she put a bucket out to collect rainwater when it would rain so she could, have extra water to water the plants without having to waste water. She was an environmentalist before I knew the term environmentalist existed or what that meant. And she was a sort of healthy living, she would put like wheat germ on my cereal when I would have a bowl of cereal at her house. She was a remarkable, incredible woman and way ahead of her time. I learned a ton from her. And then more recently, I would say, going back to Barclays Global Investors, my boss at Barclays Global Investors, Nazar Dadachanji, is an amazing man and an amazing thinker and strategist. And Nazar was on the board when we launched Camberview and invested in Camberview and helped make Camberview a success. And Nazar has always been both a friend, but also a mentor in terms of helping me think about in the business world, how I want to operate, how I want to carry myself, how I want to engage with my team. When I've had to face complicated decisions or choices, he's really wise in helping me think through those things. And so anyway, those probably are the three that, most immediately jump out to me.
Great. And are there any quotes that you think of often or live your life by?
I'm not like I don't remember quotes very well. So I'm not a quote guy, but there is a quote by Martin Luther King that I've always been really fascinated with. And I don't know if it's a live your life by necessarily, but I think it's very profound. And I don't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something about the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in times of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of controversy or complexity or something. I don't know the exact
sure. quote,
but it's I think a very meaningful reminder in life that we're all faced with complicated moments and complicated choices and difficult decisions, and how we handle ourselves and how we carry ourselves in those moments kind of define how I think how people view us and how we impact the world. And so I've always really liked that quote, even though, again, I'm not usually much of a, I don't go around reciting quotes or anything usually.
No, it's great. And is there an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Probably lots, but maybe the most interesting one is anytime anyone's homesick in my house, I have a thing where if you watch The Price is Right while you're homesick, which usually comes on at 10 a.m. where I live, it really makes you feel a lot better. So there's you have to watch The Price is Right, and by the next day, you usually feel much better if you're homesick.
That's really good.
Days very often myself, but on the occasion that I have, I always watch The Price is Right.
That's good. And it makes me think, I don't know why it made me think, but you were also the mayor of the city of Piedmont. And all your time doing this governance, how was that? And how did you do that job?
Yeah, it was a lot. I was mayor when I was at BlackRock, and I had a global team and 6 different offices around the world. And I was busy, but it was actually really fascinating because I got to think about governance in a different way. Public governance is obviously quite different than private or public company governance, but there are some overlaps. And I was basically, being mayor was like being chairman of the board of a nonprofit that I was deeply committed to. And being chairman of a board at that stage, I was very young when I ran for city council and won, and I had 8 years on city council, but I was 29 when I first ran and won. And I was mayor in my mid 30s, and so having that experience that early actually was very formative for me in terms of just growing my own human capital and thinking about managing a board and dealing with a very sophisticated CEO who was running our city and a smart set of other board members who had a lot more experience than I did. It was an interesting, kind of fun. There's a part of me that's very policy based. I have a master's degree in public policy. I've always been very interested in public policy. So filling that as I've done other things professionally has been something that's always been really important to me.
That's great. And final question, which living person do you most admire?
Well, that's easy. My wife, of course, who's my partner in life and who is absolutely amazing.
Okay. I should always prohibit that answer because it's such an easy answer for you.
It's true. She's extraordinary. If you met her, you would see exactly what I mean.
That's great. I don't doubt it for a second. Abe, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about your life and professional career and governance, really, which is, I think, at its zenith, right? This is a very important moment in time. So hopefully we'll get to see you soon. I don't know where you are in the world, but I know that sometimes you are here in San Francisco. So we should sit down soon.
I'd love to, Evan. It was great to see you and great to get a chance to catch up. Thanks for inviting me. And I will look forward to seeing you. I am in the Bay. So let's get lunch.
Great. Thank you. All right. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.